would like to start by acknowledging my parents, my stepfather and mother, who are here tonight, and do so by way of saying that my mother always has said, I don't like show and tell at my Seder. Right, Mommy? Yeah? I don't like show and tell at my Seder. So I was surprised when one year at our Seder arrived the vice president and his wife, Alan Tipper Gore. This was back in the 90s. Seems like another millennium ago. It was. And we had guests who, let's put it mildly, were not, you know, normally to be found, let's say, around our Friday night table. There were a lot of things that were very memorable about that Seder. You learn a lot of things about how you know, sort of knowledgeable and textually engaged Christians read text differently from Jews. So Jews are trained, I learned that night, when you see something in parentheses like Exodus 8:11, like you skip that. You don't read that. That's just like a footnote. Every time they read something in the Magid, it was, you read this, Exodus 8:11. So there were all sorts of different stylistic things. I would say the most anticipated and unexpected moment was as we're wrapping up the Shulchan Aruch, the main meal, and you sort of have the Shfoch HaMatcha in the not-too-distant future, the cry out to obliterate the Gentiles, I think at that point, if I remember correctly, you started to say, okay, it's been so great to have you. This has just been wonderful. And they, to their credit, said, what do you mean? We're staying to the end. Like, we're in the middle. We're not going to leave. Okay. And we proceeded, and we opened the door, and we read Shfoch HaMatcha, as we always did. And it was this very illuminating moment where it was completely clear that the vice president understood that Shfoch HaMatcha el ha-goyim asher lo yida'ucha, okay, pour your wrath out upon the nations who do not know you, was very clear to him that that asher was a that, and not a witch, which is to say, he was among those who asher yidaucha, who knew. And a sense at that moment, which is where I want to pivot now, that sometimes our expectations of who we think will find themselves in or out, and in what way, and what text they will read themselves in or out of, is not always what we expect. That Seder was very memorable to me, not only for that moment, but because it is sort of my strongest memory of the fundamental question I want to get into tonight, which is, what are we doing at our Seder table? There's a text, there's rituals, there's things that are very familiar, but what are we actually trying to do as an experience? And in particular, to refract this through the lens of the question we will delve into, which is a particular case study, as it were, of non-Jews at the Seder, okay? People who are not members in a formal sense of the covenant between God and Israel. What does that presence mean, or that absence mean, in terms of focusing us on the larger question of just what is this event? I titled this, the subtitle is Whom to Invite to the Seder, but the title of this lecture is Open House or Members Night, and I use those terms to kind of evoke the fact that we're all familiar from the larger world of moments that are really cast as being about, I want to get as many people in the room as possible. I don't care how marginally you're connected. I don't care how much you know about this institution, this event. The whole point of this is let's get everyone in. And there are other times and other contexts where we all have experienced and I think value there being events that are about members, that are about some sense of there's an inner group here that's taking stock or doubling down on the intensity of our commitment. And actually, you cannot easily do both of those at the same time. But by the end of the evening, you'll hear another story of another amazing Seder that I think tried to do this. Open house or members night, what are we doing at our Seder? Is it fundamentally an act of sharing our most compelling story as Jews as broadly as we can? Or is it the moment where we actually turn inward to reaffirm who we are, which enables us for the rest of the year to face outward and connect with people in all kinds of ways? I want to acknowledge something else about this question that will be on people's minds in all kinds of ways, I assume, but is not actually fundamentally what I'm interested in, which is to say the question of having non-Jews at the Seder, of course, has very different contexts in very different meanings and sort of pathways. There's a question, perhaps, whether it's the vice president or someone who is really outside of your family, who is really a guest. Of course, in an increasing number of North American families, the question of Jews and Gentiles at the Seder is simply a question of one's family and a question of who is already in the room. And people feel very differently about that when you get to issues of family. On the one hand, the stakes of excluding someone are much higher. On the other hand, of course, including someone sends a whole set of messages of approval that not every family is prepared to give in a way that is very different from the question of someone where the family stakes are not on the table and you're trying to figure out, is this a moment I'm sharing with the broader world? I think the texts that we're engaging are potentially applicable in a wide range of ways. I'm less interested in the practical policy question, as you will see, of what one does or doesn't do, and more in the ramifications of how the framing is going to affect what kind of Seder it is. All right, so that's where I want to take us. And the way I want to begin is with looking at an analog, which is maybe helpful, but maybe not, for understanding what the Seder experience is about, and that is the Korban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice, the Pesach offering. Okay, just to sort of get a sense of what our starting point is here in this room, independent of your opinion of this, how many folks here grew up with some kind of expectation or feeling that a Seder was not an appropriate place to have people who were not Jewish? Okay, a mix, all right? That tradition is a tradition that exists. It's held actually very strongly and emotionally by many Jews. The question of its origin is a little bit fuzzy. I want to delve into one of the potential origins of it. And that's simply the pasuk, the verse in Shmot, the verse in Exodus that I want to start with on page 1. Vayomer Adonai el Moshe v'Aharon, zot chukat ha-pasach, kol ben nechar lo yochal bo. You want to know the rule of the Pesach offering, the sacrifice that is brought once a year, basically by every Jewish family and household? A foreigner may not eat from it. V'chi agur yitchager ve'asaf pesach l'adonai, yimol lo kol zachar v'azikrav la'asoto ve'aya ke'ezrach ha'aretz v'chol ha'reel lo yochal bo. Now if a ger, a resident alien, a non-Israelite who is in the midst of the Jewish community, lives with you and wants to offer the Pesach offering, wants to be a part of that, well then he can must circumcise every male in his clan, then he can be a part of it, he'll be like the native born, but any uncircumcised man may not eat of it. All right, now this passage is kind of interesting in that it does two things. One, on some level it's almost like, do you want to know the most important rule about the Pesach offering? It's that a foreigner can't eat it. Right? Literally, it's the first thing it says. It doesn't say, Zot chukat ha-Pesach, here are the things that are the rules. Yeah, don't break a bone, and you got to eat it by midnight. And da, da, da. By the way, you can't have an outsider eat. No, the first thing is, Zot chukat ha-Pasach, kol ben nechar lo yochal bo. So there's something hinting, the text seems to be hinting, that there's almost something constitutive about the Pesach offering experience that is about pushing foreigners or outsiders out. The other side of this, which I think is interesting, when I was talking about this with my daughter, she said, yeah, you know, but it's very interesting. It seems like the anxiety around who's in and who's out at that moment seems to telegraph that people had some energy and some desire of wanting to bring outsiders in, such that the first thing you had to say was, actually, don't do that. Okay? So however we play that out, there's something fundamental here in defining the Pesach offering that has to do with who is a native born, to use the terminology of Ezrach, who is maybe a ger, later understood in rabbinic terminology as a convert, someone who has joined into the covenant, and someone who is outside of the covenantal frame. And indeed, you see that this is taken for granted, but also expanded in the early rabbinic traditions around this verse. So just look at the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael from the era of the Mishnah, but in the form of a Midrash, which comments on Kol ben nechar lo yochal bo, no foreigner may eat of it. Echad Yisrael mishumad ve'echad goy b'mashma. What does that mean? Who is considered a foreigner, according to the rabbinic reading of this verse? A Gentile, but also a Jewish apostate. Someone who was born a Jew, but has abandoned Judaism, has gone over to another religious frame, has become an idolater. There's any number of ways that this might happen, but someone who has actually abandoned their Jewish commitment in some fundamental way beyond, they don't keep that mitzvah or that mitzvah. Says the Mechilta, both of those people are inappropriate to partake of the Pesach offering. And gives a really interesting verse in Yechezkel that seems to suggest that there can be uncircumcised of heart that are in the midst of the Jewish people. Okay? So the interesting thing about the Mechilta is the Mechilta doubles down on the insider-outsider boundary when it comes to the Pesach offering, but moves it away from just the ethnic boundary, and moves it to include also Jews who are no longer buying in. Okay, think about the wicked child in the Haggadah, who in a way at the end of the story is told, you are not in, you have written yourself out, and yet of course the paradox that that child is sitting there in some way such that they can be addressed. A different kind of inner-outer boundary here is being played by the Mechilta. This is encoding what I think the Sefer HaChinuch gets at very well on the second page. The Sefer HaChinuch, a medieval work that enumerates the mitzvot and tries to play out what are they really about, is reflecting on the fact that you're not allowed to feed the Pesach offering to someone who is a non-Israelite, who is not Jewish. Okay? And he writes here in the second paragraph in the English, the basis for this mitzvah is because this sacrifice is a memorial of our freedom and our entrance into a faithful covenant with God. And therefore, it is appropriate that only those complete in that faith, Yisraelim Gmurim, I translated as bona fide Jews, should take part in it, as opposed to those who have not yet entered into a complete covenant with us. The yet there is so interesting, the adayin. And the distancing of the uncircumcised from eating the Pesach offering is for the same reason. What is the Sefer HaChinuch saying? He's saying that the essence of the Korban Pesach, this offering that is brought by every Jew, every Jewish clan each year, is actually about the reaffirmation of the mission. And therefore, someone for whom this is not yet their mission, or someone for whom it was once their mission, but they have abandoned it, cannot be around that table. Okay, let me give you another image that may help, I think, capture what's going on here. If I invited you to a rally, a political rally, and I said to you, I just want you to know, of the 5,000 people who are coming, there's 2,500 who are not sure that they really actually believe in what's going on here at this rally. Or there's 2,500 people who are interested in what we're doing, but they're going to refuse to hold a sign. Okay? That's a very different experience than if I tell you, we've signed up 5,000 people, we're all going to march, we got the chants planned out, and we're doing it in full unison. The Sefer HaChinuch is saying some version of, the strong version of, I don't want my Korban Pesach to be show and tell. This is actually the moment where I need everyone fully bought in, both definitionally and in terms of what they're signed up for. Okay? This, we'll see in a minute how this does not map so easily onto the Seder, but this is a potential sort of source or inspiration for a theory of the Seder that it is members' night. That's its function. You want to have other people, you want to invite them in, great. Invite people over for Shabbat, invite people over for the last days of Pesach, invite them any number of other times. But this is actually the night, like, let's say, the requirement for entering into a Mormon temple or being able to take the Eucharist in a Catholic Mass. That is for people who are signed up, bought in, completely definitionally a part of it. All right, and I think for a lot of people, this actually speaks very strongly in terms of what's happening. Okay, that said, the Korban Pesach, of course, is not something we do anymore, right? Actually, if you're punctilious about all the rules of the Seder, you're like very careful to be clear that you're not talking about any meat at the table as being from the Pesach sacrifice. Right, people who have the strong practice, they don't point at the zroa, point at the shank bone or lift it up, comes from some notion of, I want to be clear, we're not doing that sacrifice. So the question is the Seder actually the right mapping here? And here I want to give you another dimension that complicates what a full picture of the Korban Pesach, of the Pesach sacrifice in the time of the temple, would have looked like. So now look at the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay, on page 2. Quoting again, Kol ben nechar lo yochal bo, no foreigner may eat of it, and playing out the notion that this refers to a Jewish apostate who engaged in foreign worship. Okay, that expansion we saw in the earlier text. And then something startling happens. Remember, the verse said, Kol ben nechar lo yochal bo, no foreigner may eat of it. Says the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, why'd you need that bo? Why didn't it just say, Kol ben nechar lo yochal? Right? The foreigner shouldn't eat. Lo yochal bo, bo eino ochel, aval ochel hu bematzah uvemaror. They can't eat the Pesach sacrifice, but they can eat the matzah and maror. Not even they can, if we're talking about a Jewish apostate here, it seems maybe even they must, right? Because they're a Jew, presumably you think is obligated, but certainly they are allowed. So here you have a picture, I don't know if you think this is better or worse, okay? Which is, actually a lot of people are around the table. But when you pass around, right, communion, which is to say the piece, the olive's worth of meat from the Korban Pesach, well then the only people who get to ingest that are Jews in good standing, as it were. People signed up for the Sefer HaChinuch sort of emotional description of what's happening. But other people are welcome to be a part of the moment and actually even partake of some of the other foods. Okay? The matzah and maror, right? Think about it. It's like if you were, what would the analog be like at our Seder? It would be the closest you could come would be you have someone, they're an outsider in some way, definitionally not sort of in the covenantal frame, and they're a full participant of everything that happens all night. When you get to passing around those little pieces of the afikomen, which are the closest we have to the memory of eating a little bit of the Korban Pesach at the end of the meal, okay, so this is for someone, are you sort of in the group bought in, etc. Now, I think in a lot of ways you can there feel that tension. On the one hand, that's a much more inclusive model. And on the other hand, it also is still highlighting, oh, there's actually a moment where who you are or what you're committed to matters. Okay? That said, once we open up this box of lo yochal bo, anything about which we say do not eat of it, might be specific to the Pesach offering and not to the matzah and maror. So the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai talks about the Jewish apostate, but that same formulation is used about the Gentile. And indeed, the Rambam, when he's codifying the laws of Korban Pesach, says, if an uncircumcised man ate an olive's worth of the flesh of the Pesach offering, he violates a biblical commandment. As it says, Kol arei lo yochal bo, any uncircumcised man may not eat of it. But it is only of it that he does not eat. But he eats of matzah and maror, so too it is permitted to feed matzah and maror to a resident alien and a hired worker. Okay, these are figures who, they're not going to qualify as Jewish, but they are in your orbit. You have some kind of connection to them, and the Rambam imagines that the picture of the Korban Pesach is such that only the sacrificial meat is off limits, but these other pieces are okay. Okay, now the question of how do you translate that to a contemporary Seder is actually interesting and tricky, which is to say, so on the one hand, I can just read on the surface, and I think this is a totally respectable reading, which is to say, well, so yeah, according to the Rambam, basically in a Seder where you don't have any Pesach offering, there's no sacrificial meat, so here you go. People can be fully included. It doesn't matter anymore. There was this thing that was a divider line. We don't do it. From another perspective, you can say, yeah, but the Rambam is writing this in the context of the laws of the Korban Pesach, meaning he's imagining a full picture where there is a sacrifice and telling you it's okay for people to participate in the periphery as long as there's still a core that they can't participate in. But he wouldn't feel okay about eliminating that line entirely from the Pesach Seder night experience. I don't think we can answer that from the Rambam himself, but it's a question, right? And it is fair to say, I think, that for many, I'd say the vast majority of Jews, indeed, anthropologically, the home-based Seder is the Pesach sacrifice. That is to say, it fulfills that function of actually upping in full year after year, here we go, we're signing up again. And so the question of what anxieties that brings is a real question. I want to share with you some echoes of that, and then I'll pause after this if there's questions before we go to our second component. If you turn to page 3, there are some really bizarre medieval and early modern testimonies about this boundary between Jews and Gentiles around the contemporary Seder and Matzah potentially being breached and whether that is tenable or not. So look at the following from Sefer Talmei HaMitzvot Rabbi Menachem HaBavli. So this is a work from 16th century Eretz Yisrael. He also is writing a Sefer HaMitzvot. So he's writing a book where they're enumerating all the things that the Torah requires or forbids. And one of them is, Shelo le'ha'achil le'mishumad korban pesach, she'ne'emar kol ben nechar lo yochal. You can't feed a Jewish apostate the korban pesach, the Pesach offering, because of the verse that says that no foreigner, again read not only to be someone who is sort of ethnically, bodily a part of the group, but also someone who's sort of apostatized and abandoned its principles, can't take a part in it. And what does he say? In my youth, I saw pious people who were very careful not to give matzah to Yishma'elim. Is it Muslims? Is it Arabs? Probably both. On Pesach, this is the shocking part, v'ayu mefaisim otam b'ma'ot. And they would appease them by giving money. So what's the scene here? There's some whole population of Muslims that wants in on the matzah. That's clear, right? They want in such that you imagine the Jewish host, who will come back to the concern here, the Jewish host is saying some version of, oh, that's so great. Actually, like, why don't we go? I have some theater tickets. We can go next week instead and hang out there, right? Or, you know, I buy you this other gift, which you'll appreciate. It's even better. I'm going to give you some chocolate-covered matzah. It's going to taste even better than what we eat at the Seder. There's some kind of literally paying off of outsiders who want in, which shows you, this really confirms, I would say, right, my daughter's point that I said earlier, which is there's some moment happening here where simultaneously the need to draw a boundary feels incredibly important, and it's davka the thing that people are trying to breach. Okay? So what's going on? Well, I think we can play out in all kinds of ways, some of which are reassuring and others which are probably unsettling about Gentile fascination with matzah throughout the centuries. And we'll see that in Europe in a minute. But there is something I think it's fair to say of, this seems like it's your coolest holiday. I feel like I kind of want in. Like, if we have some relationship, this feels like the time where I would be exposed to it. And this text is reporting that the Anshei Maaseh, whoever they are, some subsegment of pious people, note it's not everyone, right? But some subset of pious people feeling like, the matzah I can't give you. Like, that's the one thing I can't give you. That's going to actually to start to break down in some way this moment mattering, because if I read back the earlier sources, this is my Korban Pesach. This is sort of all I've got. It's not show and tell. And yet, there also being an instinct that, I don't know, isn't it also kind of open house? Isn't this the story that we tell? The Taz in Europe reports, so too have I seen many who are careful about this on Pesach. Once it's in Europe, there's all kinds of concerns about blood libels and ways in which matzah is used to defame the Jewish community. But you see it's coming up again, some notion, you only have to be nizhar, right? You only have to be careful if there's some Christian asking you for the matzah, right? If they never show up, you don't have to be careful about it. There's someone who is interested, or there's someone you're interested in theory in sharing it with. This text in the Kaf HaChaim is both insane and gives you some sense of, I think, the almost, I don't want to say irrational, but sort of intense emotional energy around this. So here we have Rav Yaakov Chaim Sofer reporting something from Baghdad. He says, I heard a terrible story that happened in the days of Rav Moshe Chaim, the grandfather of Rav Yosef Chaim, the Ben Ish Chai. A Jew invited a Gentile neighbor over for Pesach and fed him matzah at his table. Okay, so here you see someone's doing it. Okay, it's happening. And it seems he mentions this in an offhand way to Rav Moshe Chaim. Ah, great Seder. Vice President came over. It was a lot of fun. He told the man that he should beware this man that year, for he might cause him significant damage. And indeed, one day the Jew was sitting and the Gentile came, that should be came with a drawn sword. Only because of a miracle did he manage to run away. Okay, so what's going on here? Something crazy. We don't know what the actual circumstances are. But here you have some sense of, if Jews start sharing their matzah at the Seder, they make themselves vulnerable. Actually, by breaking down that boundary, who knows what's going to happen? And I think this story is actually much more about that metaphorical anxiety than it is about a specific man with a sword who came in. There's some fear of, if I don't have a boundary around the matzah, which I think in a source like this is some kind of proxy for the Korban Pesach, I don't know what the next year is going to bring. And I think also this notion of bashanahi, the notion that it lasts a year, feels to me like it is channeling some notion of the function of the Seder. It's the annual re-upping of membership dues, such that the unit of the following year is kind of defined by what did I do at my Seder, right? Like, what kind of a Jew am I going to be in this upcoming year is going to be defined, in this case, how I policed that boundary or I didn't. Okay, so this is piece one, which is, to what extent can we get at the question of insider-outsider through the prism of the Korban Pesach? On the one hand, I think there's a very clear line that you can see drawn. You can also see the ways in which matzah and maror, the matzah and the bitter herbs, can easily be separated, and you can see the pathway to saying these concerns don't exist anymore. And then you see those concerns coming back in through the back door for some of these sources of, but doesn't the matzah just serve the same anthropological function as the Korban Pesach? And isn't it something about, if you will, Zot Chukat HaPesach, you want to know what Passover is really about? It's about clarifying each year who's in, who's out. That's the sort of complexity of this first model. Easily dismissed, if you want to, and to the extent you feel anxiety, this is going to be one place where it might come from and draw strength from. Okay, let me pause there. Comments or questions on that? What we think about this model, how it works, other angles here perhaps we haven't brought up, and then we're going to go to a totally different dimension of Jewish-Gentile fellowship around the Yom Tov table. Yeah?
I just want to ask you about the Rambam saying that the uncircumcised person is committing an avera by eating a piece of the Korban Pesach. If they're not obliged to do it, how could that be an avera? It may be our responsibility to keep it from happening, but why is that person responsible?
How can it be a prohibition for the uncircumcised person who, after all, they're not supposed to eat it? So if they go ahead and eat it, how can it be a prohibition on them? Maybe we're supposed to guard it. Well, I think the notion is if they're an uncircumcised Jew, they still have some responsibility for making sure that the sacred foods are not sort of abused, right? Now, whether that's enforceable or there's any way to do that is a separate question. But there's some notion, I think, encoded in that, that there's something at stake here. All right, if you will, to sort of use an anachronistic term here, there's a certain degree of cultural appropriation almost that is going on if someone eats something that they are either not qualified to be eating or they in their own life have made choices that say, I am not actually signed up for this. And then their eating is not an innocent act, but is taking the sort of sanctity and cultural significance of that food as something casual, when for the other people around the table, it's anything but that. It's some version of that. Okay? Yeah, please.
Certainly the first Passover was in Egypt, and there was a strong sense of division, and it was who's in and who's out, meaning who will live and who will die, and who will God, the angel of death, pass over. So certainly that part of it was there from the beginning.
Yeah, the inside out, I thought you were going to go even further. There's a way, if you step out of rabbinic tradition, you can almost read it, right? As that passage actually occurs before this passage appears in the Torah before they leave Egypt. You can almost read it as a rule for that year, right? Don't do this. But there's enough other rules there that seem like they carry on to the future that they have legs. But for sure, that energy of literally the passing over, right? And which house has the blood on it and which doesn't, which is a kind of test of action and faith itself, it's hardwired into that experience. The interesting question here is, well, how much is that hardwired into the experience going forward? Certainly the rabbinic interpretation is that it's hardwired into the Korban Pesach. The question is it hardwired into our seders, right? And that's the thing that I think you can see breaking two different ways on this first source. Great, take one more comment. Yeah, in the back.
To what extent do you think the difference between the Pesach and the Matzah and Maror might be because of what they symbolize rather than just, you know, a difference because of the verse, but in other words, because Matzah and Maror maybe have some more universal dimension to them in terms of what they're about than the Pesach itself?
Good. So I heard actually one beautiful reading of this, though. It's one of these readings that you could play both ways. When I was talking this over with someone, they suggested that, yeah, well, the difference is the Pesach is sort of actually fundamentally about, are you entering again into this covenantal community for another year? And therefore, it's only appropriate for someone who's ready to say they want to do that. And therefore, if you want to circumcise yourself, convert, join, etc., great, right? The Torah itself says you join right in. But that's about that. Whereas Matzah and Maror are actually about historical memories of something that happened, something that might be a powerful narrative that you might take and do any number of things within your life. And therefore, they can be radically open, right? Anyone's welcome to latch on to that memory. Of course, you could do it the exact opposite way and say that the things that are about memory should only be about people who understand themselves to have a past with this story, whereas the Korban Pesach might be the moment where anyone potentially steps in, but it's trying to grapple with your question of, is there some conceptual root here that matters? Great. Let's look at a second piece. Because another angle that comes up around the discussion of who's around the Seder table is actually a broader question of who is around the Yom Tov table. Who is around the table of a festival meal? And here on page 4, you can see this starts off with a verse in Shmot talking about what you are and are not allowed to do on Yom Tov. And it's talking about the first and seventh days of Pesach. It says the first day is a proclaimed holy day, the seventh day also. No labor shall be performed on them. Kol melacha lo yaseh bahem. Save that which shall be fed to each nefesh, deliberately not translated yet, that alone shall be performed for you. Okay, so there is a permission here to suspend the normal rules of what would be forbidden on a festival, which would normally, let's say, include cooking, which one is not supposed to do on Shabbat according to rabbinic law, and any number of other things. And to say, things that involve food preparation for you, those are suspended on Yom Tov, on a festival day, even though most of the categories of forbidden labor are identical with what you can't do on Shabbat, here there is an exception made so that you can prepare food and enjoy the day. But there are these limiting factors of nefesh, something that's done for every nefesh, and lachem, for you. Okay, this generates the passage on the bottom of page 4, where Rabbi Akiva is trying to play out, so exactly who can I cook for? Okay, it's pretty clear I can cook for other Jews who I'm sharing Yom Tov with. But the two categories that are going to be much less clear are, well, what about animals, domesticated animals? Are you allowed to prepare, cook food in that way for animals that are in your care or in your environment? And then also the question of Gentiles, people who are in my world, they're in my human world, I share that with them, but they're not part of the covenantal festival observing community. How do those two categories shake out in terms of thinking about food preparation? And Rabbi Akiva breaks it down and he splits the difference. Rabbi Akiva says, even the nefesh of an animal is included. Yes, when we say that you can cook for every nefesh, we actually mean it's not limited to humans. Okay? It's essentially any breathing thing that needs food you can prepare for. Great. So why did the Torah, he says, say for you, lachem, which sounds like it is restricting it to some subgroup, for you and not for the Gentiles? Okay, the line actually that the verse is drawing, says Rabbi Akiva, is between Jews and Gentiles. Jews cannot cook for Gentiles on Shabbat. On Yom Tov. Okay? Now they ask, but why animals are included, Gentiles are not included? Why do you draw the line there? You could have reversed it. Okay, what's the basis for this? And the answer is, because with respect to animals, you are responsible to feed them. Mizonotan alecha. Whereas with Gentiles, ein mizonotan alecha, you are not responsible to feed them. The picture here that Rabbi Akiva seems to be painting is, domesticated animals are kind of wards of their owners and of the human community. They depend on the human community for food. He actually gives you the example of klavim, of dogs, as like, right, there's this sort of bond between the owner and the pet, etc., in ways that there's a kind of codependence there, okay? And it's also the case that it's sort of equally opposite the case that my Gentile neighbor and friend is not depending on me to cook food for them. And therefore, we are focusing the exception on preparation of food on Yom Tov to cases where there's some dependency. Seemingly building off of that, we get the following interesting ruling. Said Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, one may invite a Gentile over for Shabbat, but one may not invite a Gentile over for Yom Tov, lest one increase the amount of food one is cooking on their account. So what's the fear? When you invite someone over, you want to impress them. When you invite someone over, you want to make sure there is enough food. If you run out of food, and it's a day when you can cook, you're going to quickly cook something. If you invite over a Gentile, the risk is what will end up happening is you will go into the kitchen and end up cooking food for someone who is not a part of the covenantal community for whom it is authorized to cook. Meaning, if you follow Rabbi Akiva's analysis of the verse, you potentially get to that concern. That doesn't apply on Shabbat. So no problem to invite them over for Shabbat, because on Shabbat you have everything cooked beforehand. It's done. The thing that we know you're not going to really withstand is to have just been in the kitchen 5 minutes ago making something for yourself, and now you're going to say, but actually I can't make it for you because you're not Jewish. There's no way you're going to do that. Therefore, avoid the invitation in the first place. Now, here's what I want this text to mean, but I'm not sure it means this, but I'm just telling you. I want it to mean this, but I haven't yet found the psak or the interpretation that makes it come out this way. That's very nice as a technical explanation of what's happening here. It sounds to me, though, like Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi may be making a more fundamental distinction between the regalim, between Yom Tov, the festivals, and Shabbat. And using technical language to get you to buy into the distinction, what I actually want him to be saying, in part for the theme of what I'm exploring here, but that I also kind of suspect may be going on, is Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is saying, Shabbat is universal. Shabbat is about creation. Shabbat is about rest. These are things that, whether Gentiles are commanded in them in the same way, are completely translatable and transferable. But Yom Tov is about the particular national story of the Jewish people. When you are at not just the Seder, but you are in the Sukkah, or you are receiving the Torah, you are sort of telling a first-person plural history of who you are in a way that makes it a different event, and that's not the time to have open house. Open house is Friday night. Members' night is Yom Tov. Now, I don't know if that's what he's saying. The only way you could get to the bottom of someone thinking he was saying that, but I haven't found anyone who says it yet, would be someone who says, yes, and you can't invite the Gentile over on Yom Tov even if it falls on Shabbat. Right? Because if it's only a concern of the technical cooking thing, oh, so then it falls on Shabbat, no problem. And if you follow discussions like this, this is one of those years when Pesach falls on Friday night, where you see various rabbis who talk about this and are engaged with these sources will be like, yeah, this year the first Seder is not really an issue. Because they'll say, oh, it's on Shabbat, so you don't have to worry about this Talmudic text or engage with it in any way. But I suspect that there must be someone out there who I just haven't found yet, who intuits that this may, for Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, be about something more than just the technical issue of cooking, and saying something deeper about the essence of the Yom Tov experience and the Shabbat experience. At least asking the question, again, to put it in these broader terms, what are we doing around our Shabbat table? What are we doing around our Yom Tov table? Are they different? Okay, now here too, like we saw in the earlier passages, if you look on page 5, we won't go into it too deep, there are plenty of ways of working around this text too. Just so you see this, right, in the immediate passage that follows this, right after the Talmud's like, you can't invite Gentiles over for Yom Tov. When a Gentile would happen upon the homes of Meremar and Marzutra on Yom Tov, that's sort of all you need to know, right? Okay, how would they get around? They would say to him, if you're fine with what we've already prepared, great. If not, we can't cook anything more for you, okay? But meaning what? They have those guests, okay? And the later medieval sources play all of this out and say, yeah, if they invite themselves over, it's fine. As long as they're clear, you can't cook anything. I just saw actually a psak on this from Rav Shlomo Aviner in Israel saying, yeah, I don't know which Gentiles he's imagining you're inviting over, but no problem today. Everyone cooks everything before Yom Tov starts anyway. Not in my house, but this is a trend in many homes. So none of this applies anymore and doesn't matter who you invite over. Technically, you can say that. In a deeper cutting way, if you want to see a sort of startling Meiri, another rabbinic passage from the Middle Ages, Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri is sort of famous in his commentary on the Talmud for, in a number of striking ways, breaking down Jewish-Gentile distinctions by claiming that the Gentiles in the Talmud are basically idolatrous barbarians that bear no resemblance to the Provençal Christian neighbors he knows and loves, and therefore all the rules that talk about Gentiles in this area and in that area and in that area don't apply. Very surprisingly, he does that here, right? So he does that in unsurprising places, like if there's a passage in the Talmud that, you know, suggests you don't have to compensate a Gentile for damage that you caused to their property, he'll say, no, that's only a Gentile who has no system of law who wouldn't compensate you for your property. That's why the Talmud authorizes you to be unfair back. But of course, like someone who has a system of laws you have to be equal with. But here, surprisingly, what does he say? The reason it's forbidden to prepare food for Gentiles on Yom Tov is because this is a forbidden labor and it fulfills no basic food need. Ein lanu bat zorech ochel nefesh. Ho'il ve'ein mezonotam aleinu. Since we are not responsible to feed them. Remember that language from Rabbi Akiva. The whole basis of it is, well, they can get by cooking on their own. That's what we thought it meant. What does he say? שהרי סתם גויים האמור בתלמוד פירושו בבעלי האמונות הקדומות בעבודת האלילים. Since we are not responsible to feed them, since the default Gentile referred to in the Talmud is a member of one of the ancient idolatrous faiths, implying the mizonot, or the food, of my Provençal Christian neighbor is a lie. And therefore, it's not forbidden for me to cook for him on Yom Tov. That is a different reading of mizonotam alecha. It clearly doesn't mean, oh, he's depending on me to cook for him. It's some notion of, am I in some kind of broader fellowship with him, such that it makes sense that he would sort of be an equal at my table any other day of the week, right? That's the sort of startling reading here in the Meiri. I give you that both because it's a fascinating text on its own terms, and you can ask lots of other people, how much would you follow this? Is this, you know, how many people would agree with this approach? But it's to show you, yeah, of course you can short circuit that text, right? That is to say, someone wanting to get around the Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi text that says, don't invite a Gentile over for Yom Tov, there's plenty of ways to say, well, I do it this way, or it doesn't apply anymore, etc. But I'm offering it to you as a second base of a question of, is there some energy here or some questioning of, do we have experiences that are members' night as opposed to open house? What are they? Where is that line drawn? And is the Seder one of them? Not because there's no way to escape a reading that is more closed or restrictive, but is it raising a fundamental question that perhaps we have to grapple with? Okay, question on this, and then you're going to hear the amazing account of Rav Kook Seder in Mandatory Palestine in 1924. Yeah?
What are the rulings on slaves that you are responsible for?
Great, so I brought here the Rosh. You can look, I didn't say it, who says straight up, well, of course, the household servants, etc. Like, he says, everyone always cooks for them on Yom Tov. No one asks any question. There he actually puts into play what's an uncomfortable but true class element, where he says, well, you're not trying to impress them. So the whole...
There's another test, then. It's not just that you're cooking for a guy. It's also that you're trying to impress them.
That's at least one...
But very subjective.
Correct. One angle of reading this or getting out of it is, well, if my whole concern is I might prepare more for them, well, that's only where you're going to feel like you're caught shorthanded with food and have to run in the kitchen and do something. If it's someone where you don't have that kind of relationship, it wouldn't be on the table at all. Okay? So these are, again, the million and one ways that you get around it practically, if that's the way you want to go. And that's why I'm suggesting to view Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi only through the technical lens of cooking on Yom Tov, I think maybe missing a dimension of the issue that he's raising. Okay? All right. Yes, one more question. Well, two here. Yeah, please, in the back.
Perhaps you're right about making a distinction between Shabbat and Yom Tov, but you say Shabbat and Kiddush Shabbat, so there's an element of that also in Shabbat.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. It's not as if Shabbat has no historical memory component. And again, you can say, again, I haven't proved this reading of Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi to you. I'm just suggesting it and why I think it captures something. But yeah, please.
So I'm interested in a comment you made, and I'm not sure it's exactly on topic here, but you said that Shabbat is maybe a universal story. Why isn't the Exodus from Egypt a universal story? Because there were no Christians around at the time of the Exodus from Egypt, or Muslims. They were probably pagans, but...
Beautiful segue to Rav Kook. So, this is a great account from Dor Hayom, the Palestine Post, in the mandatory period. You have on page 6 the first part of the original Hebrew, and page 8 is the part 2. If I'm going to read it from the translation, if you can follow the original, I highly recommend you read it along with me as I'm translating it. We have an account in the newspaper, okay, in the Jewish Yeshuv newspaper. Dor Hayom is founded and run by Rabbi Eliezer ben Yehuda's son, Itamar ben Avi, and this is a report. There was some like reporter assigned to cover Rav Kook's Seder. Okay, we're in the mandatory period. Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk is the chief rabbi of the land of Israel. And the governor of Jerusalem at the time is Ronald Storrs. Okay? For those of you who have read Tom Segev's One Palestine Complete, like this is, you put, just put yourself in that scene of that book. Okay? I'm just going to read to you the account. The chief rabbi, Rabbi Kuk, invited to his home Mr. Ronald Storrs, the governor of Jerusalem. The title is Seder Night at the Chief Rabbi's Home. Now, watch the timing, by the way. The guests arrived at 8:30 and were welcomed with all due honor by the chief rabbi and his family. The Seder began and the guests were invited to the table. They each received a Haggadah with an English translation. This is the best part. The rabbi explained to the guests that for the entire duration of the recitation of the Haggadah, it would not be possible for him to be distracted and to engage in conversation with them. Try this with your relatives. Because such was the evening's statutory requirement, and he begged their forgiveness. Okay? First, I'm just going to give brief comments as we go, as I read the whole thing, but then come back for a larger comment. The first thing here is, you see, Rav Kook is setting it up right away. This is a big deal, what I am doing right now. You are here, you are a guest, but I am not altering this on account of your presence. Until. The guests sat respectively during the recitation of the Haggadah, and from time to time, the rabbi offered explanations about the origins of the various customs of the Seder, along with other details about the Seder traditions. So it's not like he's head down in the book, not interrupting. You now realize the earlier comment was, I'm not going to engage in chit-chat with you. We're doing Magid, and we're going through it. If there's something I feel you want to understand, I'm going to explain it, but it's not going to be like then we're going to crack a joke. During the meal, there was friendly conversation between the rabbi, his family, and the guests. Okay, so they kibitz during the meal, as you would imagine. At 11, after the meal was finished, 2.5 hours, that's it, okay? After the meal was finished, and it was time to depart, the rabbi got up and gave a somewhat lengthy speech, as rabbis do. The rabbi explained to the guests that the essence of this historic event, a special moment of freedom for the Jewish people and its exodus from Egypt, was at the same time the most significant event in the history of humanity writ large. On account of the abundant light that came into the world when Israel and its Torah appeared, real Rav Kook language here, the great wellspring of general human culture began to flow forth. And the most enlightened portion of humanity, little bit of colonialist rhetoric here, had already begun to draw inspiration from it. We are certain, he said, that this influence will continue to grow and expand, ultimately being victorious over all destructive forces impeding it. Next page. And since it is the case that among all the enlightened nations who have recognized the great value of the biblical light, which is entirely anchored in the manifestation of the divine presence through this evening's unique event of the Exodus, the British people have a particularly heartfelt and intense connection to it. I consider it an immense pleasure and honor that sons of the British people are sitting at my table in the holy city of Jerusalem on this significant evening. The guests received the speech with great joy and sustained an uproarious applause. Afterwards, Mr. Storrs got up and answered with a speech of his own, which began with gratitude to the rabbi and his family on behalf of himself and his guests for the honor that had been bestowed upon them. He said that this event, to sit at the table of the chief rabbi in Jerusalem on the night of the Seder, was, for them as well, a historic event that they would long remember. And that the lofty words they had heard from the chief rabbi with respect to the substance of this evening stirred up intense feelings of honor, and that we are all united with anticipation that the law will go forth from Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem with the purpose of advancing all of mankind. Okay, that's an amazing scene, first of all, but I want to take it apart for what I think Rav Kook was doing there. I think Rav Kook was doing maybe the impossible, but maybe the totally possible thing of trying to have open house and members' night at the same time. Okay? It's very clear that Rav Kook felt, I understand there's politics and there's the Zionists playing with the British and all that. I get all of that. But it's very clear that Rav Kook also felt in some way, it comes across through the rhetoric, that Yetziat Mitzrayim matters for humanity. Right? The Exodus is actually a story that matters for everyone, and he feels very compelled on some level to frame it that way. And a notion that actually, if you were going to try to invite people in to appreciate the big picture story of what Judaism is about and what it has to give to the world and what it has to share to the world, you would do it on the night of the Seder. Okay? There's some element of that that I think is shining through very clearly. And the detail about, I can't interrupt and have chit-chat with you, and the most I can do is give you a little bit explanation so you can hang on while we do this thing, I think is Rav Kook's Korban Pesach moment. Which is to say, you're around this table, but I'm actually doing something here that you're not doing. And it's important for you to understand that I'm not going to step out of my role to make you comfortable. It's I'm going to invite you in to observe me doing my role with all its glory. Okay? Now that's a really hard line to walk, but I think it's what Rav Kook is doing here. For those of you asking, thinking about the Nudniki question, it was a Wednesday night. Okay? There was no loophole of it's Shabbat. Okay? It was a Wednesday night in 1924. And somehow, in any number of ways, right? I doubt Mr. Storrs invited himself over, though you never know. There was a way of dealing with that issue. Rav Kook felt he needed to, wanted to, have the governor of Jerusalem at his table. And I think what you see through some of the details is, how do I do this and not lose the Seder? How do I do this in a way that brings someone in as opposed to taking me out? Okay? And I think it's a very powerful scene that we see him actually doing this here. Let me go to the last piece here, and then I'll open it for questions. Because what I think that is getting at, and what I think is ultimately the real challenge of doing the Seder, is that experience of, can you, without irony, and fully throwing yourself into the moment, be speaking in first person plural about what happened to you on the night of the Seder? That is to say, the Korban Pesach line, the question of who comes to your table on the Regalim, on Yom Tov, is less, I think, about who actually is there. Can you find a way to permit it? Should you not find a way to permit it? It is a kind of a cipher for what mentality are you in around that table. And this seems to be the core dynamic of the entire Haggadah. The bizarre thing that we do on some level, which is to narrate the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, not through the familiar verses in Exodus in the book of Shemot, but through the terse four-line declaration of the Israelite farmer that is cited in Dvarim, here the second passage on the page, right? You shall recite the farmer on page 9. You shall recite the farmer when you bring the first fruits. My father was a fugitive Aramean. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. But there he became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried out to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm and an awesome power, and by signs and portents. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That passage is not necessarily the best or most detailed way to tell the Exodus. And yet the Mishnah on the top of the page is very clear. That is the core of what you are supposed to do in Magid, is build off of that passage. And I would suggest to you the reason is most of that passage could be blah, 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 blah. What matters is, I'll read you the only words that matter. My father, us, 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 we, our fathers, our, us, us, us. That's the power and the point of that passage. Anyone can read a narrative from an anthropological remove and decide, which part of the story affects me? Which part do I like? I like that piece. I like the way the narrator did that. I'm going to take that. It's a whole other thing to drop the irony, drop the pretense, and just say, my ancestors were in Egypt. They were enslaved, and then we were freed. And then I was given this, and we were taken here. That is already a religious experience and expectation of a totally different order. The notion that what you say that brackets the Seder begins with Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves, and ends with Ve'otanu Hotzi Misham, we were taken out of there, that's the architecture of the whole thing. That is what I think Rav Kook understood at his Seder. It's not a question of whether Ronald Storrs could be there or not. The question was Ronald Storrs going to be at a Seder where there were a bunch of Jews who were saying, we, us, our, over and over? And quite frankly, at that point, the question of who the us is, who the our is, well, then it might get complicated in certain ways, in certain contexts. That's what you see with the ger in the Torah already. That's what you see also with the Meiri starting to wonder, who are you responsible to cook for on Yom Tov? But don't forget the passage and the architecture of the Haggadah is saying that actually the whole point of this is to be able to speak in the first person and in the first person plural. That is what I think the real question behind the technical details of who is at the Seder are about. And yeah, you can have, and I've been at, Seders that are very, very different on that front. And to be honest, I think if we go to a place of emotional vulnerability, each of us has a hard time for at least part of the Seder, of really letting down our guard and without irony, just saying, this is my story. Not, this is a story I think about, this is a story I grapple with, this is a story I wonder, do I buy this part or that part? Those are all real questions. And I'm not even saying those don't belong at the Seder. But it's pretty clear, I think, starting from the Korban Pesach and following through Rav Kook trying to walk that tightrope and Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi thinking about the festivals and the architecture of the Haggadah, you've got to have that somewhere at your Seder if you want it to actually fulfill the mandate that I think these texts are calling us to. Questions, comments, responses? Yeah.
The Seder, as we know it, actually begins after the destruction of the Second Temple, when there is no longer a real Korban Pesach, and the Seder takes place of that Korban Pesach. And so all the questions of who is in, and also at the time, the Jews were actually, this was a rather depressed moment in Jewish history. The Jews having lost their temple, the ability to bring sacrifices, there needed to be something to replace that. Also, in terms of who was in and out at the time, the Gentiles were actually also mocking Jews for the loss of their temple. And so the Korban, the Seder becomes a way of to sort of resurrect the integrity of the Jewish people at the time when it would have been completely destroyed.
Right. No, it clearly plays that function in those contexts. It's played that function in different ways going forward in all kinds of places. That's why I think I'm also pointing us to the Seder is not just sort of a set of things one does and then who's allowed to be in them or not allowed to be in them. It's an attitudinal It's a sort of attitudinal experience calling you to a certain posture, and that's been in service of a lot of things at various points in Jewish history. Yeah. Please, yes, Serena.
Three things that to create a we that you can comment on or not. First of all, the Ralph Cook story sort of implies that not anyone, because nobody is Ralph Cook, but that you can qualify someone by finding some bond with them and that words are enough by saying you have something in common with them to put them in the we. So I'm a little having a little trouble with that. And then the second thing is, the other thing that's troubling me is, you can have non-Jews who identify more with the story of the Seder than mm-hmm. who are sitting at the table.
Mm-hmm.
So the we is, that's the other issue with the we.
Yeah, so let me address the second one, right? The second one, the Mechilta is already grappling with that, right? The earliest text that we saw is saying, yeah, the Jewish apostate's out too,
yeah.
Right? Which is to say, it's actually resistant to the notion of, this isn't really a Jew, non-Jew line. It's sort of a covenant line, as it were, which you can either just not be in, to use the Chinuch's language, yet, or you could have rejected it. And both of those are equally problematic according to that text. So that, it's not totally spelling out exactly how you operationalize that. And I don't think most of us are looking to throw out of our Seder tables, right, people who we don't feel are fully signed up, et cetera. But, right, the Mechilta does ask you, I think, to confront, and this is a thing that can be tricky, right? When there's someone who really doesn't buy in, okay? Right, so at its best, that's a challenge and an opportunity for engagement, and you're able to hold people close and give them a different way of thinking about it, and the ways in which, who knows, right, the wicked child as paradigm is redirected and comes back the next year at the Seder in a different seat, right? But you also can't deny that we've all been at Seders where there is disruptive energy from people who are not bought in. And it might be the right thing to have them at your table, but I don't think it does anyone any good to deny that there's some cost, okay? And that's, I think, the sensitivity here is, how do you think that through, right? So part of the we is, yeah, it's clearly, and the, you know, and the Meiri, again, not on the Seder piece, but on the Yom Tov piece, the Meiri is, of course, giving you some other way of breaking that down, which is, there might be Gentiles who are not like the Gentiles that the Talmud is talking about, and therefore those categories break differently. But again, doesn't mean the categories don't exist, it just may be the line is in a different place. So that's the first, to your second question. The question of what puts someone in the we. So look, on some level, this is where it's like, sure, you hear me using the language, and it's the language that I feel compelled by, which is the language of sort of covenant and brit and some notion of being tied to a fate and a set of commitments and being sort of entirely bought in your person, as opposed to just kind of exploring or figuring out if this is the right place. But there are other ways to draw that line, right? That is to say, here again, I think the terminology of open house and members night, right, is useful. How do institutions, right, figure out more broadly whether they use the term of membership or not, right? Or they're using, you know, colors of pages in the ad bulletin, or that whatever it is. What are the ways that institutions actually do define different subsets of their constituencies? And even if they have a vision of everyone as a potential constituent, right, that doesn't mean that everyone is the same kind of constituent right now, right? That's the other thing that Korban Pesach Afikomen moment is sort of asking to think about. I don't know that there's only one way to draw the we line. I think Rav Cook would have said, as much as I feel commonality with you, Ronald Storrs, I feel it across a boundary, right? I think he would have said, we are allies, as it were, in the sense of like we're citizens of different countries, as it were, who have a deep alliance and friendship, but we are not the same. Those lines can obviously be a lot grayer than that in many contexts, and then that raises some real questions. Yeah, we got maybe one or two or three more, yeah.
Based upon this protocol, which I agree with 100%, why isn't the Seder, why is the Haggadah straight out of Shmot to tell the story so that people around the table can really get it? Excuse me, instead of
pilpul from the rabbi.
Okay, so good. Now you are trading off. This is the I deal with this question every year. My uncle in particular loves to go crazy over this question. So part of what I'm saying is the trade-off that a person can experience in the Magid section, which is, why am I cross-referencing and going this verse to that verse, and how do I even follow this as any kind of linear experience, is the result of something else that you are getting, which is making the base text first person. Which, if I just tell the Shmot story, I am reading someone else's narrative in the third person. There is nothing personal about that story. It's Vayeanchu b'nei Yisrael min avodah vayizaku. It's not vanitzak. It is the difference between they screamed and we screamed. And that's what the Ba'al HaGadah, that's what they're interested in. By the way, the Mishnah, the plain sense is not that you necessarily have some specific fixed text like we have in the Haggadah. The claim of the Mishnah is, but your base that you work off of is those four verses, which puts you into the experience of telling this story about yourself.
I just want one comment.
Yeah.
That, I don't know, maybe I'm different. I feel as if I was there.
Yeah.
You're supposed to feel.
Yeah, but I wonder how much of that is because you've actually already imbibed this so deeply through phrases you don't even think about, like Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves, and Ilu Hotzianu Mimitzrayim in Dayenu. All of, if you go through, you will actually note the number of things that are we, our. Just go through your Haggadah this year. It's actually overwhelming. And of course, the culminating statement of V'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatzah mimitzrayim, you must find a way to see as if you came out of Egypt, both encapsulates the core message that I'm talking about, but is also a tacit acknowledgement that that's not easy. I have to obligate you to do that because your tendency is going to be, let me read you a historical account. And that Seder is not interested in a historical account. Yeah, Eric.
There are many Christians, evangelical Christians in particular, who participate in Seder or want to go to a Seder because Yeshua Nutzri's Last Supper was a Seder.
Right.
And they want to vicariously experience their non-Jewish Seder through a Seder. And so is that problematic if we're sort of the show to help them have their religious experience?
Right. So look, this really gets to the questions and boundaries of cultural appropriation and when do groups feel like something else that's a sacred first-person thing for them is sort of being used or explored, right, in a fun way by someone else. So look, on some level, you can't control what other people do, right? And I don't think there's that much sense in investing a huge amount of energy in getting people to stop doing things like that. And it's also hard to deny there's something in general when you're a minority in a larger culture and people latch on to things that you do as something they want to do. It's hard to not feel some degree of positivity around that of, well, I guess like someone might do this even if they didn't feel like, you know, they had to or that's how they were raised to do it, et cetera. So I don't want to overly comment on it because I think it also depends a little bit what the motivation is. How appropriating is it? How much is it a sort of strange, perhaps to me, way of getting into their own first-person story? What I can say from an internal Jewish frame is it makes me uncomfortable, right? Or I start to get nervous that something that for me is actually about my, you know, by the end of the Seder on the good years, like under the influence of a couple cups of wine, like, you know, screaming at the top of your lungs, singing Hallel. Because you feel like you just came out of Mitzrayim and feeling like, could someone else really feel that if that wasn't their story? Like to reenact what happened in Palestine so you're closer to that figure who's critical to you is not the same of I was a slave in Egypt, right? So yeah, I think it starts to affect what it is. Maybe one last comment. Yeah, please.
Struck by the language in the Rav Cook story, And it struck me as both generous and patronizing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you're included, but you're not really welcome, right? And this notion also of the, among all the enlightened nations, right? So it's sort of an elitist club membership kind of thing. It was a very political statement.
For sure.
Completely denudative sort of spirituality. No reference to anything in Dvarim. So I was really struggling with what to make of it. It was an incredibly uncomfortable kind of performance and political marketing piece.
Yeah, it's a great question. And you can read that story in that account with varying degrees of cynicism, right, to put it mildly. I hear you on the slightly more cynical political end of it, which may be right, right? That may be right. It may be, you can read that story as nothing more than, oh God, I got to invite over the military governor. I'm a karov lamalchut, it's pikuach nefesh, I got to save people's lives, I got to, you know, I'm in a unique position, no one else should do this, only I did. Okay, you can. As I acknowledged, even, I know, I'm going to try to give you the reverse. There's undeniably some percentage of it that's that, right? Even I acknowledge that and I reaffirm that here. I think what we know about Rav Kook and his rhetoric and other places, which actually seems like it, you know, shines through here, and what I think I don't have to read cynically, even if there's a sort of political dimension here, is that Rav Kook, also what we thought, you know, Rav Kook really believed that Zionism was going to bring peace to the world. Okay, that's like very hard for us to understand in retrospect in all kinds of ways. Not, you know, for some of us because we think that dream is naive, was always naive. For some of us because we still believe that, but we can't see the pathway to that right now. But he really believed that, right? He really thought that actually the Jews returning to their birthplace and their place of origin was the beginning of the healing and the repairing of the world. Because what greater brokenness is there than the broken Jewish commonwealth and exile? That's the ultimate brokenness. So if Jewish sovereignty and the Am return to the land, of course the Mashiach is coming. What other reading of the Messiah could you have? And in that sense, I think he really did. And there were Jews at the time who really felt this way. And by the way, there were a lot of Brits who felt this way, that the British Empire was the agent that was helping that to happen at that moment. Now, again, we may think that's naive for all kinds of reasons, and we may read it now through post-colonialist lenses that make us unable to stomach all kinds of things about it. But I don't know that that makes the event in 1924 any less genuine. And I think that Rav Kook really felt that actually there was something about the Jewish experience in Yetziat Mitzrayim that affirmed their humanity and dignity as a template for humanity and its dignity.
But he didn't do humanity. He did enlightened nations. That's the thing that...
Well, he says that, but he also does say, okay, he also does say... Right, he talks about haramata tarbuta enoshita klalit, the sort of general wellsprings of human culture, and he talks about it being hameora hayoter gadola enoshiuta klalit. This is the greatest and most significant moment in human history. I don't think that's just buttering up. I think that is Rav Kook also feeling like that's why we are so compelled about this story. We always read into this story some notion of, look at that. God saw people suffering and actually entered into history and changed it. And that there's something about that that feels like it's of global importance. And yet, the challenge is for the Jewish people to really hold that story dear and to really perpetuate it. It seems that there has been a lot of instinct and wisdom throughout the generations that they need some way of holding it as their story. Not just a story that they're marketing, but their story. The question I leave you with is, how much is the Seder night that moment? What components of the Seder night are that moment? But again, irrespective of where your Seder is and who is around that table, and whether it's more on the open house night or more on the members' night end of the spectrum, or it's some kind of Rav Kook tightrope walking, what I really bless you with, and I hope you have, is at least a few moments, if not a couple hours, though not more than 2.5, where you are just in it. You are just in it, first person plural. And to the extent there are other people around the table, they actually feel that radiating out from you. And to the extent you want a home that will draw people in, paradoxically, it may be the most powerful way you can draw people in is to have them experience that you are totally in that story as if they're not even there. With that, I will wish you a Chag Sameach and a meaningful festival.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.